Welcome to the Connected Leaders Academy Virtual Conference, designed to reshape your vision of transformation. As we navigate the evolving business landscape, our speakers will unveil innovative strategies to manage and initiate change. Prepare to adapt, innovate, and lead, ensuring your role as a catalyst in this transformative era.
Your darkest moment doesn't define your ending. It defines the moment that your comeback begins. For 12 years, I was married and working in corporate America. From the outside, my life looked like something to admire. A husband, a career, kids, home, a routine. I showed up on time. I met my expectations. I checked boxes. I did what I was supposed to do. But what people didn't see was the quiet exhaustion that lived behind my smile. Before the divorce papers were ever signed, before the world ever knew that my marriage was ending, I was already disappearing inside of my own life. There's a special kind of loneliness that happens when you're surrounded by people, yet you feel completely unseen. I would sit in rooms full of conversation and feel invisible. I would smile through dinner. I would laugh at the right moments and play my role perfectly. But inside, I felt like I was slowly evaporating. Somewhere along the way, I traded authenticity for approval, peace for productivity, identity for image. I stopped asking myself what I wanted because it felt faster and safer to just meet everyone else's expectations. At night, when everything was quiet, the truth would creep in. This isn't what living is supposed to feel like, right? But I would wake up the next morning and do it all over again, not because I was strong, but because I was terrified of what would happen if I stopped. That erosion didn't happen in a year. It happened in inches. And by the time the divorce became final in August of 2016, there wasn't much left of me to fight back. Over time, and overnight, actually, I became a single mom with fear as my roommate and shame as my shadow. Bills stacked up higher than hope. Sleep disappeared. My stomach stayed in knots. Every decision felt like a threat, and I told everyone that I was fine. But inside, I was unraveling. Fear makes you desperate, and desperation makes you vulnerable to the wrong kind of rescue. During that season in my life, there were two men. One was my abuser. At first, I didn't call it abuse. I called it stress. Miscommunication, a rough season, my fault. Because when you really feel broken, you don't question someone who confirms it. The control didn't start with hitting. It started with who I talked to, where I went, what I wore, how late I stayed, and which friends caused problems. They came as subtle shame. If you were smarter, if you listened better, if you weren't so emotional. And I believed it. Not because it was true, but because my identity was already shattered. But here's the hardest part to admit out loud. I saw some of the red flags, but I stayed anyways. Because sometimes the fear of being alone feels heavier than the fear of being hurt. Every time I stayed, the shame grew deeper, and I started asking myself, how did I get here? How did I let this become my normal? And why can't I leave? The same shame voice always had an answer ready, because this is all you deserve. And that lie took root inside of me. And once the shame convinces you that you are the problem, you stop believing that escape is allowed. My talk changed. I spoke less and apologized more. My behavior changed. I isolated from people who questioned what they saw. My mood changed. Anxiety became my normal, and numbness became my survival tool. That's TBM. Before anyone ever teaches you what that means, I will. And at the same time, there was another man in my life, my best friend, the one who saw the fear inside that I tried to hide, the one who noticed when my TBM shifted before I had the words for it, the one who knew something wasn't right even when I insisted that I was fine. But fear had already stolen my identity and my clarity. And I stayed because I was afraid of being destroyed. But I was terrified of the unknown that healing would require. By the fall of 2017, I wasn't living. I was surviving from 1 hour to the next. Every day felt heavy. Every hope felt unreachable. I wasn't dramatic. I wasn't crying nonstop. I was quiet because despair doesn't always look like panic. It seems sometimes that it looks like surrender. On September 24th of 2017, the weight of everything finally crushed me. That morning, I didn't wake up thinking that I wanted to die. I woke up wanting the pain to stop. I truly believed in the depth of my sickness that my children would be better off without me. Not because I didn't love them, but because my mind was drowning in hopelessness. And I made one desperate decision. I jumped from a moving vehicle, my best friend's vehicle. I attempted suicide. I didn't want to die. I just wanted the pain to stop. And what I didn't know in that moment was that pain doesn't disappear when you die. It simply transfers to the people who love you. I don't remember the moment that I hit the ground. I remember waking up confused, disoriented, in pain, and surrounded by machines that were breathing for me. Why didn't it work? The first face I clearly remember seeing is my mother's. Her eyes were red. Her hands were shaking. She had already lost one child, and here she almost lost another. And the look on her face told me everything that my broken body couldn't feel yet. The doctor soon explained that I suffered left post-traumatic brachial plexopathy with avulsions of C7, C8, and T1. In simple terms, the nerves in my left arm had been violently torn from my spinal cord. No finger movement, no normal sensation, and pain that feels like electricity trapped under my skin. But the physical pain wasn't what shattered me the most. What shattered me the most was the moment that I realized I was still alive. That's when it really hit. My children almost grew up without their mother. That realization crushed me in no way any other injury could. My family gathered around my hospital bed. There was no yelling, no shaming, no interrogation, only fear mixed with love. They said the words that I wasn't strong enough to say to myself. Lindsay, you don't need to be strong right now. You need help. And for the first time in my life, I didn't argue. I didn't defend. I didn't minimize. I surrendered and I said yes. So I committed myself to a mental health facility. And in that facility, everything was stripped down to my rawest form. No phone, No distractions, no pretending, just me and my thoughts and the truth that I've been outrunning. My days were broken into pieces that I couldn't control. Medication, group therapy, individual counseling, meals, lights out. Every door locked, every sound amplified, every emotion exposed. There's nothing glamorous about healing in a locked unit. Your privacy disappears, your pride evaporates, and your coping mechanisms are stripped away one by one. In group therapy, I listened to people tell their stories that sounded different on the surface, but identical underneath. Different faces, same trauma, same despair, same shame. And the hardest part wasn't hearing their pain, it was recognizing my own reflection in it. One woman talked about staying in an abusive relationship because she was afraid to be alone. Another talked about smiling at work, even though she was secretly planning her own death. And I realized something terrifying. I wasn't broken in a unique way. I was broken in a human way. One afternoon during individual therapy, my counselor asked me a simple question. Lindsay, when did you stop feeling safe in your own body? I tried to answer quickly. I tried to intellectualize it, but my voice betrayed me. And for the first time in my adult life, I cried without having or trying to be quiet. Not polite tears, not controlled tears, the kind of sobbing that shakes your ribs and exposes every wound you've been hiding. That was the day that I stopped pretending that I was okay. And that was the day that healing truly began. But healing didn't feel like progress at first. It felt like grief. Grief for the life I lost. Grief for the woman I used to be. Grief for the years that I spent surviving instead of living. That's when focus became my survival framework. It didn't arrive as a motivational quote. It arrived as the lifeline. I had to face the truth about my trauma, my fear of abandonment, my addiction to approval, and the way I had learned to equate love with survival. You cannot heal what you refuse to face. I had to own my own story, not erase it, not minimize it, not rewrite it into something easier to live with. Ownership returned my power. I had to choose courage, and courage didn't look heroic. Sometimes courage was just brushing my teeth, even though I didn't want to look at myself in the mirror. Sometimes it was walking into therapy, even when my hands and body were shaking. Sometimes it was saying out loud, I don't know how to live yet, but I want to learn. I had to understand my why. And my why became my children, not their expectations of me, not their approval of me, their presence. Their faces reminded me why I had to keep breathing on the days that I wanted to stop. And then I had to start showing up, not perfectly, not loudly, but consistently. Focus didn't make me fearless. It made me willing to feel, willing to be seen, and willing to stay. As I was healing, I learned something that completely changed how I see people around. And for talk, behavior, mood. These are three most common indicators that someone is struggling mentally or nearing a personal crisis. Their talk changes. They speak less or recklessly. Their words become hopeless. Sometimes they joke about dying as if making it funny would feel less real. Their behavior changes. They withdraw, sleep patterns shift, and they stop doing things that they once loved. Their mood changes. Their sadness deepens. Anger sharpens and numbness takes over. And here's the most dangerous part. Most of us notice these changes in others, but we don't notice these changes in ourselves. We stay silent because we're afraid of saying the wrong thing to these people. But silence almost killed me. And I'm standing here today because someone noticed my TBM and refused to ignore it. Someone asked me the uncomfortable question. Someone stayed in the conversation. And someone chose connection over comfort. And that single thing changed everything. When I was finally released from the facility, I didn't walk out healed. I walked out unsure. Unsure if I trusted my mind, my strength, or even if I trusted myself. Recovery didn't follow a straight line. Some days I felt empowered. Other days I felt broken all over again. And then came one of the hardest moments of my life. Seeing my kids for the first time after my attempt, my heart nearly stopped. I had rehearsed what I wanted to say to them 100 times, but when I saw their faces, nothing prepared me for the way the guilt would hit. I wondered, do they hate me? Do they feel abandoned? Do they feel ashamed? And then they wrapped their arms around me and said, "Mom, we love you." And in that moment, I understood something that changed everything for me. They didn't need my explanations. They needed my presence. So I started earning back the trust that the only way that you can, with consistency. I was showing up when it was uncomfortable. I was listening when it was painful. And I was staying when I felt like hiding. Slowly, hesitation turned into conversation, distance turned into laughter, and fear turned back into my family. Now that I was home, I started to learn how to live inside of my own body again. Healing didn't look bold. It looked hesitant. It looked like taking one step forward and needing 2 days to recover from the fear that that step created. I questioned everything about myself, my thoughts, emotions, strength, worth. And through that fragile season, one person never left my side. The man who's seen me at my worst, the man who witnessed my darkest moment when I jumped from his truck. He did not walk away from me. He walked towards me. He didn't rush my healing. He didn't demand explanations. And he didn't try to fix me. He just simply stayed. And over time, something began to grow between us that I never truly felt before. It wasn't chaos or fear or control. It was safety. That man is now my husband. Her love wasn't built on romance. It was built on boundaries, honesty, patience, and grace. We had to learn how to disagree without fear. We had to learn how to rebuild trust without interrogation and love without trauma writing the story for us. And for the first time, I learned what emotional safety felt like. Not butterflies or adrenaline, not constant crisis. But even as my heart was learning how to rest, my body was still at war. And since that night, I have lived with relentless pain. I went through surgery after surgery, a brachial plexus exploration, nerve grafting, a muscle trap flap transfer, a wrist and thumb fusion, and then a spinal cord stimulator. Each surgery brought hope, but each recovery brought disappointment because the pain never truly left. Chronic pain doesn't just attack your body, it attacks your mind, and it slowly tries to erase your identity. I stopped asking, what can I do? And I started wondering, who am I now that I can't do what I used to be? I grieved the woman I used to be more than I ever grieved the injuries themselves. I lost my strength, my independence, my confidence, and my sense of control. I live with extreme nerve pain every single second of every single day. It is a reminder of my darkest moment. But here's what my pain never got to take away from me: my purpose. The pain stayed, but it no longer gets to define my worth. My health slowly stabilized. My husband and I began to rebuild our lives together, not just emotionally, but practically. We started businesses while I was still healing. We took risks while I was bleeding. There were moments that the numbers didn't make sense, nights where sleep didn't come because worry was too loud. But we didn't quit. We adjusted, we learned, we kept going. Today we run 4 family businesses: Stottle Farms, S&S Harvesting, Flint Hills Transport, and TLS Logistics. All 4 of our children work right alongside us because we didn't start as a success story. We started as a survival story. Every truck on the road, every acre of land, and every late night of paperwork represents rebuilding that we once thought was lost. Then on September 18th of 2024, my mentor challenged me to go live on Facebook for 30 days. 30 days of vulnerability and showing up. The first day I went live, my voice cracked. I stared at my phone for almost 10 minutes before I pressed the button. On day 1, I thought my voice was a liability. Some days, nobody watched. Some days, a few people did. There were even days where my 16-year-old son went live for me because my pain was so severe that I could not. And on September 19th of 2025, I hit day 365. I proved to myself that my pain and my disability was not my identity. I stopped seeing myself as broken, and I started seeing myself as a woman who lived. And I realized something that changed everything. I am not my mistakes. I am not my trauma. I am not my pain. I am enough. How is your mental health today? That is a huge question that you need to ask people. My name is Lindsay Stottle. I am a wife, a mother, a grandmother, an entrepreneur, an author, and a survival. I found my voice and now I use it for others who don't have theirs. Let me say one last thing. You are enough. No more proving, no more pretending, just unapologetically you. Thank you.
Thank you for participating in today's enlightening session as we transition to our next expert. Remember that each strategy and insight is a step toward becoming a transformative leader in your field. Visit ConnectedLeadersAcademy.com to stay engaged and informed. The journey of change is ongoing. Let's move forward together.